This is the takeaway for Tuesday, January 3rd, 2017.
This is the takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Will the alarming developments of 2016 become full-scale crises in 2017? I know you're thinking about that. Put aside the cast of characters, though, who have given people reason to worry now. The tweets already about North Korean missiles, Kim Jong-un's saber-rattling, a president-elect at 40% approval rating. There's Syria, ISIS, Putin, the steamrolling Dallas Cowboys. Put them all aside. There are people who have to think hard about and calculate the real big risks of the coming year. And unlike a lot of the election predictions last November that produced more than a few never mind comments from the data freaks and Nate Silvers of the world, there are some views of the future that have to be grounded in plausible truth and actionable scenarios, even given the possibility of out-of-the-blue surprises. Every year, Ian Bremmer, president and founder of the Eurasia Group, releases his top 10 risks for the year ahead. Bremmer focused much of his report last year on America's seemingly inward turn, and America's 2016 surprise has become his top risk for 2017.
I think we can start this by saying that we've entered formally a geopolitical recession because the old world order is done. There's no more Pax Americana. The United States does not want to provide leadership on global security. It wants to shed the burdens both of allies and of multilateralism. It's not a problem for the U.S. domestic market, but for American allies and for the rest of the world, that is a very disconcerting change.
Let me push back on each one of these. On the first one, that independent America is the key risk. But what if we're just returning to a kind of Pax Cold War? That essentially the U.S. and Russia will return to a kind of, well, we can handle our own business here. Multilateralism in the diverse way it was envisioned by Obama is just not sustainable. And it makes more sense to confront China with our good buddies, the Russians.
It's pretty clear that multilateralism as talked up by Obama wasn't sustainable. He set a lot of red lines around the world that the Americans didn't end up following through on. But that's very different from saying we're reverting to a Cold War. And I think the Chinese, first and foremost, see tremendous opportunity in this independent America, because if you really wanted to revert to Cold War, your strategy would be, let's make sure that America's allies in Asia are as aligned with the U.S. as humanly possible on military issues, on trade, on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That's not the direction we're going.
Because in. Trump is pushing back on Trans-Pacific Partnership. There's disarray among those allies. And in fact, China, which is your number two risk, overreacting. What does that mean?
Well, it means that the Chinese, while they see opportunity in developing an alternative to the United States, and they'll have a lot of success in doing that economically, they also have a big leadership change coming up in 2017 in the fall, this five-year party Congress. And in the run-up to that, Xi Jinping's willingness to tolerate either domestic economic problems at home or a fight with Trump going to be very low. And so if Trump's coming in as the new president and saying, we've got a lot more power internationally, we're going to push back on these Chinese engaging in unfair practices on trade and on tax and with Taiwan, well, he's going to get it back very hard from China. This is the absolute time that the Chinese would be more risk acceptant as opposed to risk averse because of their own domestic challenges. There's no question that potential for direct confrontation between the world's two largest economies, by far the most important bilateral relationship in the world, is much more real now. And that does include military confrontation.
Number three on your list, I'll name it Find Germany. You call it a weaker Merkel. What's the fear there?
Well, risks have been significant across the European continent over the last few years. The Eurozone crisis this last year, of course, we had Brexit, with the failure of the Italian referendum. You're going to see more of that this year, too. But the one thing we've been able to count on consistently since the financial crisis in 2008 was a very strong Angela Merkel, a very strong Germany. So when crises emerge, the Germans are able to lead a response, whether it's from the European Central Bank or whether it's from, you know, more integration of top European leaders. That's not happening. She's up for re-election. She's very likely to win, but with a much weaker coalition. She's going to have to play populism at home to ensure that victory. But she just doesn't have the political capital to lead a European response to the next crises which occur, whether that is Marine Le Pen winning in France or the Italian banks falling apart or Greece with another economic crisis or big terrorism across Europe. 2017 is not going to be easy for Europe, but the resilience that they've had through Merkel, that's just not going to be there.
Is the Trump administration going to push Merkel into making some sort of rapprochement with Russia, or can she stay the course and be somewhat of a solitary figure?
I think she'll be a more solitary figure. You know, Trump would like that, but unlike Prime Minister Abe, who got on a plane to say hi to Trump right after he won, brought him a golf club as a gift, Merkel's response was a statement that said, "Congratulations, Mr. President. We're prepared to continue to work closely with you as long as you uphold the traditional values that have made the U.S.-Germany relationship important." Now, that's not the kind of response that a U.S. president newly elected typically gets from the German ally. And I think Merkel is not going to follow Trump's lead on Putin. She's going to have a very serious problem with that.
You've got three that I'll sort of rope together here. No reform, technology in the Middle East, and central banks get political. It's a complicated, arcane set of topics, but in fact, they all kind of go together. Economic reforms sort of come to an end. Technology is going to be very disruptive throughout the Middle East and elsewhere. And central banks may play a bigger role than even Merkel.
Political leaders are getting weaker in much of the world, and that is a disastrous challenge in the Middle East, where people talk about populism in Europe and the U.S., but at least in those places, the institutions are strong. Populism in the Middle East, driven by technology, taking away the oil wealth, for example, leading to social media that polarizes sectarian and tribal issues, is really making those governments much, much more brittle, making states implode. The end of ISIS in Syria and Iraq is not fixing that problem at all. It's much more structural. This is what gave rise initially to lots of terrorism in that part of the world, where across emerging markets more broadly, a lot of people are saying we need more political reform to make these economies sustainable, but you don't have strong enough leadership to make that happen. There are very few pockets of the world in 2017 where you have leaders that are strong enough to actually think long term in sustainable policy.
The big 2016 photo op at the end of the year before the holidays was Donald Trump hanging out with all those Silicon Valley leaders at Trump Tower in Midtown Manhattan. You say number seven is the White House versus Silicon Valley. Aren't they on the same page? You don't believe it?
No, and they didn't believe it when they showed up. It was an interesting meeting. They're clearly driving, you know, more of the U.S. economic resurgence than any other sector, but also fundamentally opposed to Trump in key ways. One is their control, their ownership of the new media, which Trump knows he needs to own that space in order to continue to appeal to his base more broadly. And so that's going to be a fight. And then also you have Trump much more focused on national security terrorism. It's going to roll back some of the regulations that stop the U.S. government from a lot of mass collection of data. Silicon Valley, much more libertarian and orientation. California, of course, is the one place that truly voted strongly against Trump. They're going to have a big fight this year. And I think you're going to actually see that fight being pretty meaningful this year.
I always advocate for Turkey to be higher on your list. You've got it number eight here, and North Korea is number nine. North Korea always safe on a risk assessment list, that's for sure. But South Africa, curiously, is it stalled in its transition, its political transition, and will that be a hugely destabilizing force?
It's probably a little worse than stalled in the sense that President Zuma is not going to tolerate a transition to a more popular, more capable figure, but instead probably going to try to squeeze his wife in. I mean, South Africa is the most important regional hegemon in Africa, has helped to stabilize countries around it. Again, just not available this year in any way to play that role.
I would say, you always put red herrings on your list, I would say Venezuela and Brazil. What are your red herrings?
Brazil, definitely. Venezuela, I mean, because they're suffering just so much,
oh,
it's hard
so
to say
terrible.
It's it can be a more stable story, maybe, but it's hard to imagine it's a red herring. Brazil, definitely. It's hard for me to imagine that this president gets impeached because there's no road after that. And so despite the scandals, this isn't a bad year for Brazil. But another one I focused on is the U.S. domestically, the U.S. at home. With the Republican House and Congress, there are a lot of things that can get done that were functionally stalled under Obama. I think most specifically about spending money on infrastructure, but I also think about a corporate tax bill. I think about regulations becoming more rationalized. There are a lot of things that are going to be very political happening in the United States that some will like and some will hate. But from an economic growth perspective, 2017 under Trump actually looks okay.
So, Mr. Planner, Mr. Thinking Ahead, did the aliens land in 2017?
I make
some headlines here.
I'll tell you. So the thing that worries me the most is that in the last 20 years, I would say the likelihood of major military confrontation among the world's serious economies was functionally zero. And I think we can't say that anymore. It's not high. But I can give you scenarios where the U.S. and China, U.S. and Iran and Saudi Arabia, conceivably even the U.S. and Russia, depending on how sustainable the rapprochement is, end up at blows. And while I don't think that's global nuclear, you know, annihilation, I do think it would lead to an economic depression. And so I think that the geopolitics, which have been, you know, interesting and very troublesome in certain parts of the world, we now enter a geopolitical recession is real. And the potential for that to become very dangerous for us is probably the single top issue over the coming few years. And that's not something I'm used to discussing.
The top 10 risks for 2017 from the Eurasia Group. Ian Bremmer is president and founder of the Eurasia Group. Thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
Will Congress drain the swamp of corruption, as the president-elect insists, or build a new swamp by quietly stripping the budget to defang the independent congressional ethics oversight operation in the House and Senate? Trump tweeted out today, with all that Congress has to work on, do they really have to make the weakening of the independent ethics watchdog, as unfair as it is, maybe their number one act and priority? Focus on tax reform, health care, and so many other things of far greater importance. Hashtag DTS drain the swamp. Well, they were listening. The whole ethics affair is now up in the air right now. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, says it's unclear where it's all going to land.
Well, John, just about 18 hours after House Republicans went behind closed doors and tried to make a quick and quiet move, dialing back on the Office of Congressional Ethics, the OCE, they've reversed themselves. They went back into conference just 10 minutes before the 115th House was going to convene to pass a new rules package. And then they came out just a couple of minutes later, having reversed themselves. Here's Trey Gowdy of South Carolina. You remember him from the Benghazi committee. And I caught up with him just as he walked out the door.
First rule of Fight Club. You don't talk about what happened in Fight Club.
Now, come on now. You all decided to undo the changes to the OCE.
That portion of the rules package has been withdrawn, I think is the best way to phrase it.
Now, John, what Republicans wanted to do here was take the Office of Congressional Ethics, that's an independent ethics panel, and basically weaken it. The OCE has operated since March of 2008 when Nancy Pelosi was Speaker. After a whole bunch of ethics scandals where members went to jail, several members went to jail behind corruption charges, and Congress came up with this new system, largely because the House Ethics Committee, which is run by members of Congress and where members of Congress police themselves, was viewed to be inadequate and kind of feckless. So the OCE was independent. It had the ability to take complaints from the outside, from interest groups, from the public, even anonymously from the press, to investigate alleged ethical transgressions, rules violations, and even illegal activity on the part of members of the House. It was independent. Now, it didn't have the power to punish lawmakers, but it could issue reports. And once it reported to the Ethics Committee had to turn around and investigate, or if not, explain to the public why it wasn't investigating. Well, House Republicans wanted all of that to go away. They kept the OCE, but they wanted to move it pretty much under the skirt of the Ethics Committee. It still got to investigate stuff, but lawmakers, again, would have had control over what the OCE investigates. They wouldn't be allowed to issue their own reports anymore. They wouldn't be allowed to take anonymous complaints. There was a lot of reaction. Donald Trump tweeted that this was a bad move by House Republicans, and constituent reaction was overwhelming. Here's Charlie Dent. He's a Republican from Pennsylvania.
And I had cautioned some of my colleagues last night that one provision would create quite a public stir. It did.
So, John, the House convenes today. They're passing a rules package. Paul Ryan is elected the new speaker, of course, but they will do it without what proved to be controversial changes weakening to ethical oversight in the House of Representatives.
Lots of ceremonial sort of symbolic stuff to take care of today, administrative swearing in stuff to take care of today, and then they get down to Obamacare.
This is most important in the Senate. If the Senate can get a budget going today and this week and they vote on it in a certain way, and I won't dull your brain with how this works, John, they can wind up repealing Obamacare with just 50 votes. You don't need the 60 votes that you would ordinarily need to overcome the filibuster in the Senate. This process is called reconciliation, and the process starts today. But it's not going to happen overnight even when they vote on repeal. There's going to be this long, drawn-out repeal period that Republicans in Congress haven't decided on yet themselves. It could be 2 years. It could be three. They could even delay this until after 2020. Republicans are increasingly sensitive about the political liability of actually repealing the thing they've been trying to repeal for 7 years. And they also know that once they repeal health care for the first time, Republicans own health care. They have to come up with a replacement plan. They don't agree on what that should be. They don't agree on how many people they should try to cover or for what cost and exactly how to do this. Republicans are looking for a cushion to immunize themselves politically from taking away benefits and trying, they hope, to put something better in its place that people will like. And this is what you're seeing, John, when you step back from this, is the rush to get a couple of things done among congressional Republicans. They have two top priorities, both of which start right away. Repealing Obamacare is number one, of course. Big tax reform is the other one. Republicans have been wanting to do this for years. Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell want to move quickly. They want to get these cars in the garage fast because that first 100 days is key for any president. And it's especially key, frankly, for a president that politically is as weak as Donald Trump. He's at a 40% approval rating right now. We know that he didn't win the popular vote. Regardless of tweets and what the Trump transition says about his historic win or his strength, a low approval rating like that taking office is gravity. And you can't deny the law of gravity. And that makes people on the Hill want to move quickly in the first 100 days to get these things done. And that's what they're doing.
We're also going to see today how serious John McCain is about investigating the Russian involvement, alleged Russian involvement with the hacking in the election.
Look, we all know how Democrats feel about this. They're enraged and they feel like it's a major liability for Republicans and for President-elect Trump. But you've got a number of Republicans, especially in the Senate, the defense hawks, who want major investigations. This week, John McCain, who is chairman of the Armed Services Committee, says they're coming right out of the gate with a major hearing on Russian hacking and cyber assaults on U.S. democracy. So McCain is not taking Donald Trump's advice to get on with our lives and sort of forget about hacking. And this stuff could come up in substantive ways, too. Another thing that gets started right away are hearings on some of Donald Trump's cabinet nominees. Now, they can't approve any of them because they're not officially nominated, of course, until Donald Trump is president on the 20th. But some of the hearings get started right away, and Russian hacking and Russian interference could become a broader issue in nominations like Rex Tillerson for Secretary of State, for all of the burnishing of his credibility as a great potential diplomat that the transition has been doing. There are signs that broader concerns over Russia, a reset with Russia, cozying up to Russia, or not taking Russian security threats seriously, that all could start to come down on a nomination of Tillerson. And there's not a lot of running room for Trump on Tillerson's nomination. He can only afford to lose two votes. And if you have defense hawks like Lindsey Graham, like John McCain, like others who are putting the brakes on it, it's something the administration's going to have to respond to.
Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much, Todd.
You got it, John.
The dawn of a new year brings hope in Chicago. It's hope that the city may find a respite from the violence that has plagued neighborhoods in 2016. Gun deaths there spiked to levels not seen since the late 1990s. Two decades have passed since then. The pain of lost loved ones echoes in the hearts of family and friends, and the current high levels of violence tormenting Chicago are an echo. We've been here before. Takeaway member station WBEZ in Chicago has been featuring stories from residents recounting the loss of loved ones during that violence in 1998. This piece comes from a mother and her daughter, reflecting on the death of their son and brother.
My name is Siona Owens. I'm Robert Owens' mother.
My name is Sharon Berkman Owens, Robert Owens' sister. He was sensitive. He was a cooler kid. I don't know. He was just mushy. We call him mushy because he looked. He had a little funny face. Yeah, and he had this little funny little mouse face, and that's what we end up calling him the name.
And mush mouth. Remember, we said mush mouth, and mushy just stuck. Yeah. The day Mushy got killed, now you know what, my mind just went completely blank. And I got bars on my doors. I could not get that key to work to save my life. I took off running, but for some reason my legs was just like lead. And by the time I got there, I'm still saying in my head, because this can't happen to me again. You know, I've been the mother of seven kids. I've lost four. I had two died in a fire, and I had one died at birth.
He was killed by a 12-year-old white kid that was basically living in a Mexican and black neighborhood.
He was he was in a gang, and his initiation was that he had to go out and kill somebody.
I took out my anger on what happened to Mushy on all teenagers. My son had a friend that was about the size of the kid that killed my brother. I hated this kid.
If I only had said, no, you can't go out tonight. Because that was my goal, not to let him go out tonight. I left Chicago because I didn't want to be there anymore. It wasn't safe for my family. I mean, people's getting killed. I've seen seven of my friends' sons get killed and stuff and everything. Then I was next. No, I didn't want to be there anymore. And I still don't like Chicago. And I go back there now. And I'm so aggravated. And when I come right back here, up here in Kenosha, I'm just like I'm at peace.
I feel sorry for the parents that have kids, young kids that's there. Because when Mushy got killed, you didn't really hear this. I mean, you heard kids killing kids and stuff like that, but not like that. It was like a shock when you hear something like that. But now it's getting old. We hearing it every single day.
I used to watch everything that goes on in Chicago. You know, I'd live for any little piece of news, but it would just got, every time somebody got shot and killed. I can't deal with that stuff anymore, because when you're constantly looking at some child and got killed again, and then this, that mother going through that, it's just too painful to watch, because you already know you've been there. A month ago, October the 24th, my nephew was shot and killed in Kenosha.
I was at work, and I got the phone call, and I felt the devil come out my soul. I had to take off a week from work, and it brought back Mushy all over again.
Everybody had to take off a week from work. This used to be my safe haven, and I said, nobody can touch us here. You know what I'm saying? This is Kenosha. Now, you know how I feel right now? He got shot and killed. Now I got to start worrying again. When you shoot that boy, you shooting that whole family. When you take that one bullet, you have destroyed a whole family. You might as well say you shot everybody.
Siona Owens with her daughter Sharon Bergman Owens remembering the death of Robert Owens, who was shot and killed in Chicago in 1998. Their story comes to us courtesy of member station WBEZ and reporter Miles Bryan.
What stood out to me particularly were the young victims. We wanted to look at kids who are so young, they haven't even reached high school age, and yet they're being victimized by violence.
The voices say it all there in the previous segment, but 2016 was a most violent year for the city of Chicago. Murder rates hit levels not seen in two decades. The cause of the spike may be a grisly social adjustment to what officials hope is not a new normal. Patrick Smith is a reporter for member station WBEZ in Chicago.
41 shootings is just so much higher than any time in the last 10 years. It's basically 2013, 2014, and 2015 combined. And they're up more than even our big increase that we saw for shootings overall.
What do people say that they think is going on, people in the neighborhoods?
There's one sort of common theme that I was hearing from people that I think would be really hard to quantify, but I can say that I haven't talked to a single person about this who didn't say it, which was something that I heard from the grandparents of Takara Morgan. This is a six-year-old girl who was shot in the stomach over the summer. Her grandparents told me that they think there isn't as much of a stigma on accidentally hitting innocent victims. Basically, they have normalized the idea that you might accidentally hit a little kid who's not involved in the shooting you're doing.
They don't care no more. They don't even care about life anymore. I don't think they care about their own life.
Well, how can you care about somebody else when you don't care about yourself? You got to first love your own self before you love somebody else.
So that's Johnny and Arthur Morris, grandparents of Takara Morgan, who was shot in the summer. And again, that's one voice, but you heard this again and again.
I heard it again and again from people in every neighborhood in the city, and also from criminologists, and I heard it from police. I talked to Superintendent Eddie Johnson, who leads our police department here, and he said he not only is seeing that callousness from gang members, but he thinks that people in the community are also not as shocked when an innocent victim is killed or wounded in one of these shootings.
When you have a police-involved incident in a community, there's a lot of outrage. There's no outrage when you see a young kid killed by a gang member, and I don't understand that.
I mean, that is a sense of hopelessness, I mean, from my perspective. But are people withholding information from police because they don't trust them or something?
Well, that is one thing that Eddie Johnson said he thought might be going on, basically that there's a narrative now that police are the bad guy and that in poor communities, they just do not trust the police. They don't want to come forward. Eddie Johnson says they're not getting the information they need to solve these shootings. The numbers I looked at, police have made arrests in just 3 of these shootings. So there are 41 shootings in which a young kid was wounded or killed. Police have found who did it only 3 times. So that's a staggering number. Superintendent Johnson says that's in large part because people won't come forward even when there's this very young victim.
So we've heard all this outrage about police brutality, but gang violence doesn't move the needle in the same way?
It's interesting you say that. I mean, that is certainly what you hear from police. I don't know if that's true. I do know that Arthur Morris, Takara Morgan's grandpa, you know, he said he knows there are people who he sees every day who look him right in the face and they know who shot his 6-year-old granddaughter and they won't say anything. And you can tell just how upset and frustrating he finds that. But he also said that he blames the police for not solving this, for not solving the shooting that wounded Takara, for not solving almost any of the other shootings that wounded little kids. And I thought it was really interesting what he said, because Eddie Johnson said, you know, people in the communities don't care about gang violence. They only care about police brutality. This is what Arthur Morris said about how police respond when someone gets shot.
Let one of them get shot. One gets shot this morning at 10 o'clock. 5 o'clock this evening, they got whoever shot him or her. But one of us, they look for somebody to shoot me or you once in the presence of you. They're looking for him then. They tell him, well, we're looking for him. But when you turn that corner around there, he ain't worried about it. His mind will flip somewhere else.
That's really a devastating indictment. What impact does the shooting and the persistent sort of lack of prosecution do to the community?
Well, it has a devastating impact on the family. I mean, Takara, fortunately, she's got a scar on her stomach, but besides that, she physically is okay now. But mentally, you know, she watches every car that goes by. If she hears a loud banging outside, she lies flat on her stomach. She doesn't get to be sort of a happy-go-lucky kid. Her mom has high blood pressure and it wants to move. Her grandma says she's afraid to go outside. I mean, it just has a devastating impact on the family. That maybe isn't that surprising. What I think is also really important is that the impact isn't just on the family, it's on the whole community. When you have something like this where an innocent kid can be shot and there are no repercussions for the people who do the shooting, it sends shockwaves. It kind of means no one is safe. At least that's what I'm hearing from people. I talked to Timothy Ferguson, who has 4 young kids. He lives on the west side of Chicago on a block where a 13-year-old kid was shot at about 11:30 on a Saturday morning.
I saw the 13-year-old, he's sitting on the back of a fire truck, spitting up blood. And I'm a homeowner, and I want to stay in my neighborhood. I want to raise my kids. I can't even take my kids outside. I have to take them to the suburbs to play in the playgrounds.
Now, we should note, we've been focusing on these 41 shootings of kids under 13, but there were 762 murders and more than 3,500 shootings in Chicago last year. That, in and of itself, is a huge increase over 2015. Why the spike? Is there a consensus?
There is no consensus. It's something that I've been putting to a lot of people. I've heard from criminologists and people in the communities that that there's more desperation and more hopelessness in the poor communities here, that the kids who are doing the shootings do not see any other options for themselves. I've also heard that there's easier access to guns, or that, you know, gang rivalries are amped up over social media. But none of those things are new, and I don't know that they answer the question of why this big spike. Superintendent Eddie Johnson, who we heard from, he subscribes to the idea that police are pulling back because of all the focus on officers and because police are being seen as the bad guy, as he puts it. You know, he's not saying that's the only reason, but he has certainly said that police are pulling back. They're not making as many stops. They're not making as many arrests. And that could be contributing to the spike in violence.
Well, whatever the reason, the trend line seems to be in the wrong direction, absolutely, as we begin 2017. Patrick Smith, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Patrick Smith is a reporter with WBEZ in Chicago. A 17-hour prison strike and takeover has shocked officials and Brazilians used to the worst in its prison system. Around 60 people were killed. Some were decapitated and dismembered in a battle for supremacy over the cocaine trade in the Amazon city of Manaus. Simone Romero is Brazil bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. It's so great to talk to you.
Thanks for having me on, John.
Put this in context. The prison system is always a source of violence and unrest, and actually an active political culture within the prison system. How do you rate this 17-hour prison strike in terms of what else is going on in the country?
Brazil's prison system is no stranger to riots, rebellions, or uprisings. These are frequent occurrences up and down the country in overcrowded prisons, that are really teeming with inmates. You know, Brazil has seen a huge increase in its prison population in recent years, with a lot of people being rounded up on minor drug offenses. And you've seen the burgeoning of these prison-based drug gangs that are operating from prisons around Brazil, especially in São Paulo, which is Brazil's largest and most populous state. But now you see this happening in more sparsely populated parts of the country, like the Amazon and the city of Manaus. And this riot, which lasted 17 hours, was just horrifying to many Brazilians, even people who may think that they have been hardened to seeing such violence in the country's prisons. You had inmates who were beheaded, their corpses, their dismembered corpses were thrown over the walls of the prison. You had negotiators going in who were shocked by what they saw, describing scenes of almost medieval carnage.
And it was motivated by individual battles taking place within the prison, or is it a response to the conditions within the prison itself generally?
Well, these gangs are really quite sophisticated. They are based in prisons, and they originated in prisons. You know, it's very easy to corrupt guards in Brazil and to get weapons and cell phones and computers to operate a rather sophisticated business, and that business is drug trafficking, focused on the cocaine trade. The borders that Brazil has with Peru and Colombia and Bolivia, the largest producers of coca and cocaine, are really very porous. So the product comes in through the Amazon, and you have these prison-based gangs fighting for control of that trade, both from within the prisons and on the streets of Brazilian cities. They have operatives in big cities, small cities, small towns. And so this is really a turf war that they're raging. And you had a large prison-based gang coming up from São Paulo wanting to expand its reach into the Amazon River Basin. And you had a rival gang fighting back, essentially. And the leaders of that gang, which is called Família do Norte, or Family of the North, they essentially massacred more than 60 members of that rival gang in a retaliatory move.
And why would they be out of reach of the authorities inside a prison?
Brazilian authorities have been investigating these groups for years, really for decades, and investigating very closely. It emerged in the Brazilian media last night and this morning. They were intercepting text messages and phone calls of leaders of these gangs from inside the prisons that showed that this gang was planning this massacre, planning this retaliatory move against its rival. So the authorities knew about this, but they really couldn't prevent it because they don't have full control over their prisons, unfortunately. Often what you hear from many Brazilians in private settings is that they're quite fine with having prisons be these cauldrons of violence because they believe that the criminals who are convicted of violent crimes and can sent there, that they deserve to live in those conditions, unfortunately.
Simone Romero, Brazil Bureau Chief for The New York Times, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
In 2016, you know, there was some really out there talk about space.
So you said that your goal is to eventually take a million people to Mars.
Millions, yeah.
But isn't that going to be expensive? Are people going to be able to afford that?
The key threshold, I think, is $500,000 to move to Mars.
Why is that?
In order to achieve that, you have to, first of all, have a fully reusable system that can travel to Mars and back, and you have to pick the right propellant combination. And I think with methane, methane oxygen, you can do it.
Whoa.
Methane oxygen, folks, you know, remember that. That's billionaire entrepreneur Elon Musk being questioned about his Mars trip. I kind of vote him as most likely to have come from another planet himself. He's talking about his SpaceX Ventures very serious initiative to get people to Mars. And it was just one milestone in space last year. If Mars doesn't work out, there's the Kepler project that has found 5,000 or more planetary alternatives. It's a new space race between the public and the private sectors, but everyone wins, and the real future may actually be in public-private partnerships in space. Much more in this year of 2017, including updates on the Cassini, the Juno, and the ExoMars missions. Joining us now, Emily Rice, astrophysicist, professor of astrophysics at the CUNY College of Staten Island and the Graduate Center, and a researcher at the American Museum of Natural History. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Emily.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell me about what's exciting in 2017.
Oh, man. So in addition to, you know, making the next steps going towards Mars, there's a lot of stuff going on, both on Earth launching and kind of in the solar system as well as in the rest of the universe. $500,000 to Mars, that's pretty impressive. Like, you can't move to Manhattan for that amount of money. So.
Right, so it's a number that you can deal with.
Yeah, yeah.
Some people can anyway.
And there's always, there's a lot more steps that Elon Musk has to take with SpaceX in order to get there, but he's putting his money where his mouth is, and we're going to see the first launches of the Falcon 9 after the loss in September on the launch pad. And they're talking about putting, you know, testing the Dragon human capsule again, the crewed capsule that can launch on the Falcon, and then maybe even putting people in that. So there's going to be two uncrewed test launches of that are planned for 2017. And then they might even have people in it at the end of this year or the beginning of 2018. And so that's exciting to have, you know, an American vehicle go to the International Space Station again.
Uncrewed. That's a good alternative to unmanned. I've been looking for one for years. Thank you very much for that.
Uncrewed, absolutely.
That's a milestone for me in 2017. let's talk one more thing about Mars here. I went to the Museum of Natural History earlier this week, and the data set of Mars from all of the space exploration, it's amazing. They can take you on a 3D trip into the canyons of Mars in the planetarium there. It was an amazing kind of invitation-only event, but it's eventually going to be something for the public.
Oh, yeah. It's an amazing – this is like the work that I do at the American Museum of Natural History is both research and outreach, and so I also get to present planetarium shows sometimes, and it's like – being able to play in a like the best playground ever. Sometimes I call it Nerd Disneyland. And the data that gets in there, so this Mars data, a lot of it is from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter.
Real.
Yeah, it's real data. And even, you know, the surface images that this camera has taken on Mars, you can find them on the internet. But in the dome, they've taken it and they've put it where all the images belong on Mars. And so you can make this high-resolution map. They have one for the moon. They have one for Mercury. They have them. There's a new one for Pluto.
Pluto is coming, right, exactly. And the resolution is only going to get better and better and better. Speaking of resolution, what are the missions that have cameras and other sorts of devices out in the solar system and the universe for 2017?
So interestingly enough, for 2017, one of the most exciting things is the end of a mission. It's planned, and so it's not going to be catastrophic, really. You know, it won't be a surprise, but it is something that is going to be a little bit sad. The Cassini mission is ending in 2017. It's planned for mid-September. But the exciting thing about that, this mission, it was launched in 1997.
Wow.
Like, think about, you know, what you were doing. I wasn't even studying astronomy in 1997. It's wild to me. And then it got to, the Cassini mission got to Saturn since 2004. And it's been taking pictures for over a decade. Pretty much any image that you see of Saturn or of the Saturn's rings or moons is from the Cassini spacecraft. It's just revolutionized our understanding of that planet and its entire system. But the cool thing is this mission has been extended for so long that now it's like, okay, we've gotten a lot out of it. And now at the very end, it's like we can push it to its limits a little bit. So they're getting very adventurous with its orbit. And right now it's in this orbit that's called the F-ring orbit, where it's a very elliptical orbit. So it goes from very far away to very close up, and it's just grazing the edge of the rings. And so taking these really close-up pictures of the outer edges of the rings. And then later this year, it'll actually change to what's called its grand finale orbits. And it'll do about a couple dozen orbits actually passing between the planet and the inner edge of the rings. And so that's just going to be super interesting.
And then it will spiral down, and that'll be the
end. And then on September 15th, it's planned to actually plunge into the atmosphere of Saturn and burn up. And hopefully make some measurements along the way, but they want to make sure that they kind of destroy the spacecraft effectively so that it doesn't actually hit any of the moons that could be potentially habitable. We don't want to do anything that could affect any...
Do no harm.
Yeah, basically.
Right. What about launches in 2017?
I think the most exciting launch for 2017 is actually going to happen at close to the end of the year. Maybe it'll be pushed into 2018, but let's call it 2017. It's the TESS satellite. And we, you know, we talked about SpaceX before. This is actually going to launch on a Falcon 9 rocket from SpaceX. And I think it's the first NASA science satellite to be launched on a Falcon. It's called TESS. It's the Transiting Exoplanet Survey satellite. And this is kind of like Kepler on steroids. So you mentioned Kepler before and how Kepler has found thousands of planets.
By charting the diminishing light from stars because the planets make a shadow as they go around, and so they've calculated that. But this will give them much higher resolution and much more data.
It's much more data. It's not necessarily higher resolution, but what it is it's looking at a lot more stars. And it's also looking at brighter stars. So the Kepler mission looked at one area in the sky, and this is an all-sky survey. So it's going to look at hundreds of thousands of stars, but all over the sky, focusing on the brightest ones. And that's important because these brightest ones are going to be easiest for follow-up. And so not only are we going to be able to find the planets, but we'll be able to follow up more on them, do more observations more easily, and actually find out more about these planets.
Any places that you're dying to go?
Yeah, Proxima B.
Is that right?
Yeah. So this is one of the most interesting discoveries of 2016, I think, is that there is, you know, if we can't find anywhere in the solar system we can live, there's potentially a habitable planet around the next closest star to the solar system. So there's the Alpha Centauri system, which is a binary system of two sun-like stars. But then there's actually a smaller star that's technically a tiny little bit closer than those two stars. It's called an M-dwarf star, so it's much smaller and cooler than the sun. But last year it was announced that this has a super Earth planet around it. So it might not be a habitable planet, but it's in the habitable zone of that star.
A few propulsion issues, a few engine and propulsion issues to work out, and you're on your way.
Yep.
Emily Rice, astrophysicist, professor of astrophysics at the CUNY College of Staten Island and the Graduate Center, and researcher at the American Museum of Natural History. You called it the
Nerd Disneyland.
Nerd Disneyland. Welcome back. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Here's a little nerdy thing to take with you today for your scientists who've tried to develop tissue media, a generic human tissue. Doctors call it a scaffold. Using stem cells to grow into organs, noses, skin, chins. 20 years ago, the Chinese developed something called the ear mouse, a naked pink mouse-grown ear, actually a piece of cartilage taken from a cow's knee and implanted onto a living rodent. But this year's stem cell breakthrough might allow scientists to actually 3D print replacement human ears to correct injuries. So far, because of bureaucratic problems, there are no commercially available ears in the U.S., but China is way ahead, treating thousands of injured people. So perhaps this year the words "lend me your ears" will acquire a literal new meaning. One more thing to make us all kind of nervous. If you're going to take the takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. You don't need a 3D printer. Find us on iTunes. Take us with you anywhere you go. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turn cognitive research tasks into games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. Enterprise Florida, working to promote Florida as a premier business destination for companies interested in relocation or expansion. More information at FloridaTheFutureIsHere.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.